Accession number 24730, Reel 10.
Mr. Boxall, Reel 10. We're talking about your time in the Samichon Valley between November and, I think, March, February, yeah. March, anyway. What happened as you went into January? It got even colder.
It was really, I suppose it was something like 30 degrees below zero in the middle of the night. It was really cold. But whilst we were there, they did have parts of the platoons go back to build what they called a fallback line in case we were attacked and had to move back. I didn't have anything at all to do with that part of the operation. All the while we were in the Samichon Valley, there was patrols out every night. There were patrols coming through us because that was the main way into the Samichon Valley. So we were one of the forward companies, and most nights we were involved with either a patrol out or a patrol going out through us. And sort of during the day, you after you'd stood to and tidied up and got yourself cleaned up and washed and shaved and had your breakfast and carried out various tasks that had to be done, then you rested as much as you could because you'd be up the following night again.
Did you ever move company positions or did you stay in the same place?
No, we stayed in the same place. We never changed.
So it was never rotated position?
No.
It was always you?
No, we were there. We were in the Samichon for about 3 months.
You seem to have left on the 9th of March.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else you remember? There's this action where Henson another company, C Company got an MC.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that going on? Was that just another patrol to you?
Just a patrol. They obviously went out through C Company, who were the other frontline company. So we didn't have much at all to do with that. He was eventually killed.
Now, what did you think of the Chinese and the North Koreans? I mean, what was your attitude to them as people and as soldiers?
The Chinese and North Koreans, from what I could see of it, were given a bowl of rice or a bag of rice, and they were away. They didn't need or didn't expect to be looked after like our troops were. I mean. And they were saying with the Americans, I mean, the Americans had what they called foxholes, which they lived in, which was a little hole in the side of the hill that they crawled into. Well, now, our troops wouldn't have stuck that. They had to be able to get walk into their bunkers and had to have a bed. They didn't expect to crawl into a little hole in the side of the hill.
What were the Chinese and North Koreans like as troops? I mean, were they tough enemy, you know, dangerous troops, like, say, the Germans?
No, not really, no. They were... As I say, it was numbers with them. I mean, they didn't attack in ones and twos, they attacked in hundreds, from what I can hear of it. Although we were fortunate we never attacked.
Did you consider that they fought fair? I mean, sometimes you can be fighting troops and sort of respect them.
I think they were a bit barbaric, to say the least. I mean... I've heard since the way they treated the prisoners wasn't all that...
Did you know at the time, though?
No, I didn't know at the time, no.
So, anything else that you remember about happening in the front line before you pull out on the 9th of March?
No, not really. It was sort of normal routine, daily routine. Keep yourself clean and...
Any close escapes?
No, not for me, no.
Any problem with the company with lice?
No, never had anything like that. In fact, in the Samichon Valley, we bought our own bath unit.
Tell us about that.
Well, there was a little stream ran down through our hill, and we decided that we'd make a bath unit, so we got a big oil drum. I'll give the Jeep driver, this drum, a couple of shell cases, that we had welded into it to make a boiler, and give it them, and said go down to the Americans and get that welded up, and which he did. I think we sent them down a bottle of whiskey or something, we were doing it. Brought it back, set it up, and we used to run the water in from the stream, add a couple of drip feeds into these shell cases, which then heated the shell cases, heated the water, and then we arranged a tube and a tin with some holes in it to make a shower, and the company used to be able to get a shower every week instead of walking about 3 or 4 miles down the valley to get to the bath unit. So it was a bit amateurish, but it worked. And as I say, you know, we made sure that everybody could get clean, could keep clean.
Were there any sort of animal life or insect pests?
Rats were the worst blooming thing. We had rats were a blooming nuisance. In fact, I had a Sergeant Wild Goose who was ex-Sussex Regiment with me in my bunker, and there used to be a rat used to run around the ledge every night. And Wild Goose stood there with a loaded carbine, and he said, one night that rat's going to stop, and I'm going to get it. And one night it did stop, and he blew the rat apart from about 2 foot. And there was bits of rat all over the blooming bunker, but he got it. But it was overrun with rats.
Any other pests?
No, rats were the blooming trouble.
What about contact with home? Letters and parcels?
Letters, we had comforts come from Norwich, which they'd arranged for us.
What sort of comforts?
Balaclavas and scarves and jumpers and things like that. But I mean, as far as balaclavas were all right, scarves were all right, but you didn't expect people to walk around with bloody pretty scarves around their necks. Well, I didn't anyway.
Would you get parcels from your family? You know.
Yes, you know.
What would be in them?
Well, it depends, I suppose. I mean, I wanted a new pen, and my wife sent me out a Parker pen and pencil, which I had for blooming years. In fact, I think I've still got a pen somewhere. Mostly it was letters. I mean, I had a letter from my wife saying that my son had got appendicitis and was in the hospital. She was allowed to go in and see him any time during the day or night. But luckily he had a burst appendix, but luckily he got over it. But he was in York Hospital for a few days. And I said to the company commander, what do I do? He said, well, hang on, you might get a letter telling you he's all right. And that was what we did. But, yes, it was sort of letters.
Were letters important?
Oh, yeah, it was important that you heard from your family. I mean,
did they write regularly? I mean,
oh,
weekly,
yes, more? Yeah, weekly. Probably once or twice a week, my wife used to write.
What would she write about?
I mean, well, I don't know, telling me what was happening and how the children were getting on, because, as I say, my oldest daughter was born on the Saturday before I came, had to go back the following Saturday. So, you know, she'd write and tell me how they were getting on and what they were doing. And
what would you write about?
Write about what we were doing.
Would you play it down?
I mean, oh, yes, yeah, you wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't tell her about people being killed or wounded or anything like that, although she wouldn't know what it was like because she was a nurse during the Second World War. That's where I met her. So she would know that, you know, in wartime people get hit and wounded. But
you didn't dwell on it?
Well, no, you told her what you were doing, what the food was like. And
Were there any welfare problems in your company? I mean, and what would happen about them? I mean, I'm thinking about people who got Dear John letters, people who had, like you, nearly had trouble at home. How was it dealt with?
Don't remember anyone coming along saying, you know, I've had a Dear John letter or anything like that. If there was a dashing reason, I mean, in the case of, say, someone dying at home, by the time a letter or something had got out to Korea, to tell the person. That was no good saying, oh, well, we'll send him over to the funeral, because you wouldn't get him there in time. It would take 3 or 4 weeks on the boat to get him home. There were no such thing as flying them anywhere. So it was mainly the fact that, you know, you had to, they had to get on, and I don't think I can remember any sort of pressing welfare things like that. I mean, in my case, all right, my son was ill, but then by the time I got the letter, he was probably much better. And by the time a few more days and I got another letter, he was all right. So, you know, there was no problem.
Did any of the men suffer from nerves or problems? You know, I mean, did you have any problems with people losing nerve other than that second in command?
Not really. No,
not the first major, yeah.
Yeah, not really, though. No, I suppose they did. They were nervous. They did get probably a bit worried. But on the whole, they got on with it and did their job.
There was nothing that could be done for entertainment, I presume, in the line.
No, we did have one or two ENSA people. I went to a concert once with Larry Adler, came and played his mouth organ.
Where was that? Was that while you were in the line?
Was in the line, yeah. We went down and it was a big tent somewhere that they'd arranged, and Larry Adler was there.
You couldn't all go back, obviously.
Oh, no. There was only a few odd people went back. I was one of the lucky ones, I suppose. We did have a concert party come out when we were out in reserve once.
All these concert parties, were they any good?
Well, I always found, even during the war, that if a young lady got up in a lovely evening dress and could sing, she brought the house down. Or if they were a good comedian. But some of them were fairly second rate. I mean, some of them wouldn't have got on Sunday night at the London Palladium, not in the month
of
Sundays.
What about Larry Adler? Because he was quite a big star, but he's not a comic
he played his mouth organ in this tent. Just walked up and down the line, playing his mouth organ and cracking a few jokes. But
so he was humorous.
Oh yeah.
And was it appreciated? Because he'd be
Yes. I mean, it made a change if you got some entertainment. I mean, because we didn't have wirelesses and things like they have now. I mean, there was no music or anything broadcast on the wirelesses. I mean, people didn't have wirelesses in their bunkers or anything like that.
Anything else then before you moved out in mid-March?
No, we moved out in mid-March to a reserve position.
That's the Peacock Hills, or Peacock Hills is somewhere. It's by a reservoir, I think.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. But once again, it was only out there for a little bit of a rest and relaxation.
About a month.
Training, about a month, yeah.
Anything happened, or...?
No, not really. And then we moved back.
Would you have a sergeant's mess? You know,
there would be a sergeant's mess there. I used to go down there, or go into the sergeant's mess and sit and have a drink. But as far as I was concerned, we didn't drink too much. I mean, you always had to be in a fit state to go and fight if you had to. So, we weren't there long before we moved back to Finger again.
To where?
Finger. We went back
to
Finger again.
Oh, back up to
Coang Sand. Yeah, yeah. And
you actually went into your old positions?
Yeah.
That would be April.
Yeah, and...
How had it changed?
Well...
If at all?
It had changed a bit. Different units have been there. We took over from the Americans. So there weren't nice big bunkers or anything. So I got the porters, the Korean porters that we had, to dig me a big bunker, which was about half the size of this room. Well, it was room enough for two beds to be in it and a table. And I had a log roof to it and plenty of earth on top. And as I say, the MOU's at it is regimental aid post when he came up when we had patrols out. At the same time, we had the Americans left a lot of tree trunks on the other side of the valley, and I said to my driver, three-ton truck, go and get them, load them up, bring them over here. And they brought all these logs over, and I said to my porter, right, I want a log hut. And they built a log hut with them.
Behind the hill?
Yeah, at the back of the hill.
And what was that for?
That was for the Austin and Charles Mess. And Gilchrist didn't think much of that. He sent a message up to me to... he wasn't having warrant officers and sergeants messing with officers to close it down. And Ben Chapman said to me, what are you going to do, Sergeant Major? I said, take no flaming notice.
And what was... Tell me what he offered then, you know, I mean...
Well, he didn't like...
It seems funny to have a sergeant's mess so close to the front line, you know.
Well, the thing was, I mean, there was me, there was a platoon sergeants, there was a three platoon officers, and plus the company commander. Now... We had nothing. We couldn't sit down together. You couldn't go and sit down in a men's mess room tent with them. So we had nothing. And I decided that we wanted...
So it was officers as well?
Officers as well,
so
yeah.
It was officers...
Officers and sergeants, yeah. And that was what Gilchrist didn't like. But
he didn't like the fact that the officers were in as well?
No. I said to the company commander, it's all right for him, he's got a sergeant's mess down at the CP, we've got nothing. And I want somewhere that we can sit and have our meals and have a natter if we want to. So that's what we did. And we had quite one of the sergeants said to me, I know where there's an old stove in a hut where we go wooding. So I said, right, send a party out and bring that in. And they brought that in. We made an oil burner for it out of an old bit of a shell and some diesel oil. And one of the blokes said he'd like to do the cooking, so he became our cook. And he cooked for the 3, 6, 7, 8 of us. And I thought that, you know, that's all right. For people down at the CP to say, oh yeah, you mustn't do this and you mustn't do that. But they never bloody will come up to see how you're getting on. I mean, Gilchrist, not once did the RSM come up to our company in the whole year that we were in Korea.
That would be not what you expect.
I would have expected him to at least come up. Well, you would expect him to come up on odd occasions. I mean, even when the commanding officer came up, you'd expect the RSM to be with him. But he wasn't. And as I say, he never came up to our position once in the whole year we were in Korea.
What about the RQMS?
RQMS, oh no, he was back at BS, and that was a few miles back, and you never saw him.
But the colonel did visit?
Oh, colonel did, yeah, come up, yeah. And company commanders from other companies came up on occasions. Company sergeant majors from other companies came up on occasions. I mean, Tim Chatlin used to come up and see us, and... Dingy Bell used to come over from C Company and see us, and I'd perhaps go over to see Dingy Bell and sit and have lunch with him in his bunker. But
so the company, the senior NCOs or warrant officers,
yeah.
and officers of each company would liaise with each other. They'd
oh
visit
yes,
you.
Yeah, but they didn't have a mess like we did. We were the only ones who had our own little log hut. But
I want to ask one thing. You'd mentioned in the history is a problem with rubbish disposal, and the fact that when you took over, there was a lot of rubbish left about the place. Now, you hadn't left it like that.
No, we hadn't left it like that.
Tell me about the rubbish problem.
Well, when we went back on, I think it was a Samichon where we went out, and then the Royal 22nd Regiment, the Vandoos Canadians, took over from us. And when we went back in, the place was a tip. There were empty beer cans. What they used to do is lay in their bunkers, drinking beer, sling the cans out through the door. There was no such thing as, you know, keeping the place tidy. It was covered with empty beer cans and rubbish.
So that was the problem. And when he took over the finger again, that was...
That wasn't too bad, but once again, the Americans didn't... didn't live like we did.
How would you clear? How would you disposal?
Well, we'd have.
What was the proper way?
Well, the proper way was to have a proper trench to throw all your rubbish in. Proper toilet trenches made, so that people could go to the toilet.
So sticking with the rubbish, I'll come back to the latrines. The rubbish would be gathered.
You'd have to gather it all up and then put it in a rubbish dump. You'd have a place where you could dump all your, a big pit that you could, you dig, that you could dump all your rubbish in. And that had to be, you know, you had to keep, well, you had to keep the place clean. It was no good, well, that was all right for some lots, but not for us.
So there'd be no rubbish at all?
No, you wouldn't have people slinging their empty beer cans out or empty beer bottles or anything like that if they did the, you'd jump on them.
What about bits of food, you know?
The food had, once again, had to be properly disposed of. I mean, when they came out of, when they had their meal, they had to clean their plates off. They had to be cleaned off into a receptacle, and that was then emptied and buried.
Now, what about the latrines? Take me through
latrines. Once again, you had to have latrine trenches where people could go to the latrine and be safe as well.
Now, what arrangements were there? I mean, were there actual toilets, or was it a pole, or
no, no, it was
thunderbox or what?
It was we did have thunderboxes, and you dig a trench, fit these thunderboxes on them, and then once the trench got too bad, you'd fill it in and dig another one.
Were they using quicklime or anything?
No, didn't have things like quicklime. Blimey, couldn't afford them. Army couldn't afford things like that.
It was just buried.
What?
It was just buried.
Yeah, just buried, yeah.
Was there an adequate supply of paper and stuff?
I mean, oh, yes, yeah, you could all, yeah, you take the colour sign sort of brought that up with the rations.
So what happened in it? You took over the finger section in what? Halfway through April,
yeah.
51. And there seems to have been quite a bit of serious patrol activity.
Yeah, there was,
quite
yeah.
Few,
yeah.
I mean, this is
that was the one place where, where we did, they did try, in the latter part of our occupation there, they did try to catch a prisoner, and they had a various number of patrols out, and there was quite a scrap during the night. One of our lieutenants was fairly badly wounded. Two or three of them were missing. And one, eventually, we heard was a prisoner of war. They did get one or two prisoners, but they didn't survive. They had a habit of dying on you because they didn't want to live, I think.
So this isn't anything about them being killed?
They got one in who's got, I think, had got a wound on his face. But he just lay there and died. There was nothing, he wasn't mortally wounded or anything, but he just didn't want to live as a prisoner, I presume.
And anything you remember about your time there? What other things?
Well, no, once again, it was patrolling and a normal routine.
There was in June, there was a fighting patrol from A Company under Captain Robertson and Second Lieutenant Gunton. Quite a successful ambush. I mean,
yeah.
Would you be aware of things like that?
Well, yeah, because I think that was the one where Gunton was wounded. And he came in. There was him and his batman were wounded, I think. Once again, you know, it was a skirmish that didn't really have any great significance.
Now, there was a problem when a patrol, this looks like B Company, but Chapman was involved later on, where they wandered into a minefield, and
yeah.
It seems there was a problem with not properly identified minefields in No Man's Land.
Can
you talk to me about that?
That was the thing. I wasn't there on that night. I was away somewhere. But what happened was that B Company had this patrol going out, and the company sergeant major was the patrol commander. Well, he hadn't really been doing any patrols, and he got into this minefield with his patrol and I think five of them were killed. He was badly wounded. And Ben Chapman went out with a patrol, with another patrol from A Company, and went into the minefield and got them out. But I always did say that I think the main person who was at fault was the company commander for allowing an inexperienced company sergeant major to take out a patrol. And B, the company sergeant major was at fault for taking the patrol out because it's not the company sergeant major's job to take patrols out. Someone said to me, well, you never take patrols out. And I said, no. When I was a platoon commander, a corporal and a platoon sergeant during the war, I used to be out on patrol nearly every night. Now, you get to know what to do and what not to do. But then, suddenly, after you've not done it for years, to suddenly go out with a patrol and command it, you don't know the ground, you don't know what the problems are, and of course, this patrol wandered into this minefield, and five people were killed needlessly because the company commander hadn't done his blooming job, as far as I can.
So this minefield was marked? I mean,
well, I don't know that it was. I can't say it wasn't, I can't say it wasn't. But I should think it was. The wire might have been damaged or blown. But, I mean, someone who'd been used to taking out patrols and knew the area would have immediately known that that minefield was there. And the fact that it was taken out by an inexperienced person, although he might have been senior, in my view, was wrong.
What about, this seems to have carried on, this prisoner business. I mean, there's Operation Yarmouth, as you said, towards the end of the time, they seem to be mad keen on getting prisoners.
Mad keen on getting a prisoner. Well, they did, on this Operation Yarmouth, get one or two, I think, but they didn't survive being to live. I think when they got them in, they had a habit of giving up the ghost and sort of dying without any specific reason. I mean, not that they'd been knocked about or one or two of them had been wounded a bit, but a lot less people wounded a lot worse than those didn't die. So it seemed that they weren't over keen on being prisoners.
Now, what about anything? What's the next thing you remember happening? Because obviously you weren't involved in these sort of things so much as Operation Yarmouth, Harvest.
Yeah, no, I wasn't. Other than the fact that most of it went out to A Company, most of them came up to A Company to be briefed on what was happening, and we got them back in, and any wounded and that came in, and were looked after in my bunker by the MO. But other than that, no, I wasn't very much involved in it.
And so what's the next thing you remember? What was the weather like in summer, actually? I mean,
well, the weather in summer was nice. It was nice and warm. We wore green drill, parkas and windproof clothing were all handed in, got rid of, returned. And the weather was quite nice and warm. I mean, you could walk about with no shirt on or anything, and if you were working.
And anything else happened to you that you remember?
No, not really. No. We finally came out of the line in the end into a reserve position.
That was in round about 7th of August or 8th of August?
Yeah. And the battalion was in reserve in a position. There was a big sergeant's mess that Gilchrist had built, and he decided that we would have a farewell party. The only trouble was a silly twit sent out invitations with a map reference on of where we were. We were going to have this mess party, and lo and behold, on the day that we had it, we got shelled. Now, I'm not saying that the Chinese or North Koreans got a copy of the invitation, but somehow they got to know that we were having a party and where it was, because they couldn't have shelled us for any other blooming reason.
What do you remember of that? You must have been there.
Well, I was sat down inside the officer science mess behind the sandbags.